This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Carl Marlantes. He's the author of a new book called What It Is Like to Go to War. Carl wrote an earlier, a book I interviewed him about and loved, a novel called Matterhorn, which is about Vietnam, or about 1965 or 66. And this book is, again, about some of the experiences that Carl had in Vietnam, but obviously as a nonfiction book, a very different take. Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm just fine.
So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the book itself and what spurred you to write it. I look at it as a kind of, it's a philosophical treatise, but it's really also practical in many ways, you know, in the context of how you feel about war and its role in society and what it means for the people who are actually the warriors.
Yeah, it's like Matterhorn. This book only took 20 years instead of 35 to get published. But when I was writing Matterhorn, I was dealing with just a lot of stuff from the war, post-traumatic stress disorder, and things that a lot of, you know, people deal with. You're raised in a Judeo-Christian culture where, you know, it's bad to kill people, and then your government sends you out and says, well, kill these people, and you know, you're expected to come back and get a job at McDonald's. And I was just going like, you know, we as a culture just don't prepare our 19-year-olds very well on the more spiritual soul side of the equation. We do fine technically and, you know, well-trained that way, and they're getting way better in terms of psychology. And certainly, people, when I came back from Vietnam, people hadn't even heard of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Or when they had heard of it, they tended to dismiss it as a kind of weakness that you shouldn't even talk about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And not only that, but lately has been quite a controversy in the active military. And I think that people are coming around to understanding that it actually is a physiological change to your brain, which occurs under the stresses of combat. It's a healthy adaptation to an unhealthy situation. But once you have it, you can't change it back. And it's weird because, I mean, our culture has written about it. Odysseus had it. You can read about it in the Odyssey when he is asked about, tell us the story of Troy, when he's at, was it Nausicaa's father's banquet? And I mean, you can just go right down that passage and you can see the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder once you know about them. But in any case, back to the book, I just I was dealing with that myself, and so I started writing it down, sort of exploring how I felt about all the various aspects of going to war. And then I thought, well, I'd write it so that if there was some kid that thought maybe he'd like to be a professional military person. I'm no pacifist. I mean, I want guys to, you know, go into the military, but I don't want them to be romantics. I want them to go in knowing exactly what is going to be asked of them. And if you really want to do this, then God bless you and off you go. And also for veterans that have come back from the experience, it might just, you know, if I can just sort of honestly say, well, here's what I think about it and here's what I felt about it and, you know, put it out there, I just felt like maybe it would help them to come to terms with their own experience. And so I just kept working away at it. And obviously once Matterhorn was published and it was successful, then it was easy to get this one published.
Well, I think in a lot of ways this book is like an instruction manual, kind of spiritual, psychological, metaphysical. You address kind of, you know, these deeper levels of what it means, not only, as you say, what it is like to go to war, but what it means for the people. And actually, you're really challenging the society to rethink how and think more deeply about what it means to engage in warfare.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, some of us feel differently than you do about whether, you know, whether war should is necessary or should be used as a tool. You know, that argument you really don't engage in. What you're engaging in is kind of, if you accept the fact of war, then you need to deal with it in a different way than
Yeah.
we currently do. And a lot of it seems to be the contradiction of, you know, the people who actually fight the wars, physically are engaged in combat, are 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20, you know, 23-year-old. They're young, and they haven't formed conceptually ideas about what they're doing. It's more like just go out there and do it.
Right.
And
And yeah,
and it
and
seems
one
like
other
you're
thing.
challenging people to think about that, you know, challenging them, but also the people who send them.
Yeah, very definitely. I mean, I try to make the point. It's somehow, you know, people will say, oh, well, we're just citizens or we're just policymakers. And I think I'd make the point. It's like the 19-year-old that's pulling the trigger is no different than. He's a weapon for the policymaker. And so the policymaker is doing exactly the same thing. He's just not up front and personal where the ugly stuff happens. But they've got to think that we're actually using these kids as weapons. And they're terrific weapons. I mean, like you say, if once you accept that the country is going to go to war, those are the ones you want. But they're not at an age where they're going to be reflective and thinking about what's going on. But when they come back, they're going to have to deal with it, and you know the citizens and the policymakers aren't. And so I was sort of like, you know, how can you help these guys, and how can you try and make it better than it has been? I think ancient cultures, from what I can read, had a little better handle on it. And even if sometimes it was because of I don't know if you call it just mistaken ideas. I mean, for example, if you went to war believing that God was on your side, you actually are better fortified, whether you were right or not. I mean, I don't actually believe God is on anybody's side in the war. I think God thinks that we're just really stupid to be doing this, and you know, God's about individuals. But in any cases, in these ancient cultures that we lived in, there was sort of a more of a, I don't know. What's the word? There's more structure around the psyches of these warriors.
Right, it
And for
was more
today,
actually integrated, as you point out. I think you talked about this extensively in the book, is that there were rituals, there were celebrations. The war was integrated into the psychological fabric of those cultures,
right.
and they were it was a way to both accept and you had to then defuse the warrior mind. When it came back, you know, the warriors come back into the society, they have to go through a period of readjustment, which, you know, in our society isn't really dealt with kind of visibly. You know, you think about the people who came back from World War II and never talked about it,
Right.
couldn't talk about it, just internalized it. They weren't supposed to. And same with the guys who came back from Vietnam, so many of whom suffered because there was no context for them. To adjust to reconcile what they did, as you said, to what they were, you know, what their belief system tells them they're supposed to do.
Right.
And ancient cultures, and I think, were much better organized at ritual and in kind of effectively doing that reintegration process, because there's a language for what you're going through.
Yeah, and a history of it. It's sort of like, you know, when the warriors went off, when they came back, this is what they did, and then they came back into the mainstream of the culture again. And yeah, I mean, we have a problem with terribly isolated veterans. I mean, you know, I know guys who are still up in Alaska from Vietnam, and they're never going to come back because they feel better up there because you know there's that isolation is. Is sort of, I think they feel imposed by the culture we live in. And I don't think anybody's trying to be mean. It's just the way that, you know, we don't talk about that, you know.
Well, no, and that's, I think you talk about that in the book, the contradiction between what it's, when you're in war, you're in a high state of preparedness. Your every fabric of your, you know, every piece of your being is alive. I think you know, there's an addiction to you know, for people who do extreme sports, they maybe have the same sort of thing, that you become addicted to your high level of awareness. Your you know, you always have to be running. You always have to be bicycling 500 miles. You know, that the same sort of thing, I think, happens to a soldier who's in that, in the state of war. And how do you come down from the high? And then what do you do? Is it all going to be really boring if you don't have that excitement anymore?
And probably equal to that, I mean, that is a very big component of it. Equal to it is this sense of meaning. If you're 19 and you become, you know, a squad leader, you have like 12 people, their lives depend on you. And if you're just an individual soldier, if you don't do your job, somebody dies. You are extremely important. And then you come back, you know, and by this time maybe you're 20, and you know, like I say, you get a job at McDonald's or something, and if you don't show up for work, who cares? So there's suddenly the sense of your place in the universe, how meaningful your life is to those who are around you, is suddenly gone. You will never be, you know, very few people will ever have lives that are ever again that meaningful to others, and that's hard to adjust to.
Right, where you begin, yeah, exactly, and it's sort of like maybe another comparative. It is maybe diminishes what you're saying. I don't mean to, but if you are a star athlete, you know, and your athleticism ends when you're 30, let's say.
Yeah.
The rest, you have to decide, figure out, who am I? I'm no longer out there on the playing field doing that great work, you know, having fun, being the star, being so involved with my, you know, your teammates. There's a kind of, I think that's really similar to what happens to a military person who's been in the front lines. Yeah. You know, then you come home and there's like, what do I do now?
Yeah.
And also,
not only what do I do now, but nobody wants to talk about what I did.
Right.
Well, at least the athlete can talk about the game.
No, that's true. And in fact, people love talking to the athlete. The difference is people, there is in our culture anyway, because we have such a deep misgiving, a deep sense of misgiving about what it means to go to war.
Yeah.
That the society, we're uncomfortable with that. And maybe it's a sense of denial, in the same way that you say the person, the leader of the country who sends young people to war is using them as a weapon. Well, in reality, the entire society is doing that, and even further distanced then, because they didn't make the physical decision. They didn't press the button that sends the guy, or make the call.
Write the executive order. Yeah.
Right, they didn't do that, but they elected the guy or woman who does that.
And they paid the taxes.
That's right. That's us.
They worked for a company that, you know, if they worked for somebody, like they were a farmer, they made the food that made the people in the weapons factory eat.
And well, and if we drive,
we're all connected.
Right, we drive a car with oil that was gotten because somebody went to war to protect the oil supply. Literally, we are all, if you want to say culpable, and I know that's a charged word, but we're all responsible for what those soldiers do. And then there's this vast gulf between their experience and the regular citizen's experience, and a vast psychological gulf of responsibility. That, you know, if I feel uncomfortable with that idea, you know, with the idea that somehow those people are doing things for me that I would not want to do myself or couldn't do. And maybe because, you know, as you're older, you don't. I mean, it's only the young who go. So, and then because of that sense of differentiation of roles and responsibilities, most of the citizenry, it's not even that you don't appreciate what they did, but that you really don't want to know what they did in detail. It's too much. It's like going to a movie, an X-rated movie. You just don't want to know.
That's right. Yeah. Can I go get the popcorn now? Yeah.
Right. And I think that's why some movies like, you know, The Hurt Locker were so powerful, because they really show what it's actually. It's a lot about some of those. The themes of that movie are what we're talking about. The, you know, this incredible engagement that someone has that they just, you know, they don't know how to be somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a tough one. And yet, if they're going to be a healthy individual, and believe me, it's astounding how many guys come back from that experience and they have families and they have jobs and they become grandparents. I mean, they somehow make it, but a lot don't, and we could do a better job.
Well, I think that's one big message in your book, and that is that there's an obligation then. If a society is going to send kids to war, the obligation to take care of them when they come back is profound. And is really neglected. It's not just having the VA hospitals have a budget.
Exactly.
Having what you're talking about is really more the metaphysical and spiritual and psychological framework and a society that could restore a balance to how those, and you, as you, I think it's your word of calling them warriors is a really good term. I think it helps explain who they are and what they've done, and gives them respect as well from the point of view of society. But there isn't a structural integration. We don't have as you, what you talk about, we don't have the rituals. We don't have the kind of psychological structure that brings them home and reintegrates them into our society.
We even have a sort of a false idea of it. I mean, I think with most combat veterans, I mean, we sort of cringe when people start waving the flag and shooting off fireworks and stuff. And, you know, my analogy is that if a surgeon just had to take off somebody's leg because it had gangrene, you wouldn't then, you know, celebrate with fireworks and parade. That he's just done his job. And, I mean, a warrior is used when we've all failed as adults to come to an agreement with whoever we end up fighting. So they're cleaning up a mess. The kids are cleaning up a mess. And when they come home, to me, the image is they should walk down the street with the rifles upside down because of the sadness that has been created in the world that they participated in with good hearts to try and right, and that what they need is to have everybody hug them, not to, you know, have a band playing.
So what do you, I mean, in practical terms, what would you do? You know, what would you propose, let's say, as would it be part of the military's kind of mustering out of people to include both a military form of disengagement and then a societal form of re-engagement.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, I mean, I think that we need to, as communities, make conscious our reacceptance of these warriors back into our culture. And there's ways that this can be done. We actually have things set up that would work. I mean, there's, you know, synagogues and churches and there's local, I don't know, fraternal clubs. I mean, there's lots of organizations and just families themselves. I mean, when I came back from the war, my mom and dad showed up at the airport, but no one else did. And it would have been nice if everybody else had come, you know, in my larger extended family, and people would have just been warm. And that sense of you're back in the fold again, that's a very different feeling. And I think the other one is this idea of it ain't a football game. I mean, yeah, we won, you know, okay, World War II, but that isn't a cause for celebration. I mean, 20 million people died, like, or more. I don't know what the number was. What this culture has to say is, we just went through this experience. I'm so glad you've come back home, and thank you for doing the job. But this is not something we cheer about, and I think that we ought to, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, not in the military anymore, and they probably would throw me out with this suggestion, but I firmly believe that when we say prayers about the ones that are dead, we say them about this other side as well.
You mean the other side, the people,
the enemy.
The enemy, not just the other side.
The people
side,
we killed, because you've got to reconcile it. Those are 19-year-olds just doing what their culture wants them to do. There, but for, you know, I mean, I get born in Seaside, Oregon. Someone else gets born in, you know, North Vietnam. We end up shooting at each other. One dies. The aftermath of that, you should recognize that both of those individuals were thrown into something that was bigger than they were. One of them came out alive, the other one didn't. The being, you know, thinking of them as thinking of us as the victors is just sort of a little bit immature, in my opinion. I mean, you're damn glad you're alive, but I think that you have to mourn not just your own friends that died, but all those other 19-year-olds that there, but for the grace of God, you'd have been born in that village.
Right. Well, but so how do you, I mean, this seems to me like the profound challenge that, and of course, I wasn't in the military and I never killed anybody, so I don't know. But it seems like, and you talk about this also, that this this knowledge that you are responsible for the death of another human being, and it may be many in some cases, or it only may be one in others, it doesn't really matter in some ways, because of the society teaches us that that's literally wrong. Yeah. But it's okay to kill when you're in this situation. So, but I don't know, it's not enough to say it's okay to kill because you're in the Army, you still, or the Marines, or whatever you're mm-hmm. in, you still have to reconcile. In some cases, you actually saw the person you killed.
Yeah.
In other cases, you didn't, but you know that you, as you said, these are 19-year-olds who were just like you, except that they're on the other side.
Yeah.
And so, but how do you deal with that for those individuals? How do you deal with the, either it's guilt or sense of responsibility, and how do you help people? I mean, that seems to me like that's an individual thing, not even whether they get hugged when they come home, but right. more that they need some form of really long-term structure to reconcile yeah. it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the coming home is just the beginning. And a lot of these, I mean, it goes on for years. And not only that, but you come home, you're 19 or 20, you're not real introspective at that age. I mean, I didn't start getting images of people I killed until I was in my late 30s, I think, because I was busy, you know, I was doing stuff, you know. And I want to put all that behind me. You can't put it behind you. It does stay there. And I think that simple things like therapy, veterans groups, even if families became aware through, you know, maybe reading a book like mine, that it's okay to ask their returning veteran, what did you do, and tell me about it, and let them feel safe about talking about it, instead of, Jesus, if I tell this person what I did, they're going to think I'm a horrible person because I did pretty horrible things. You've got to just, you know, be able to make that kind of an environment that way. And I think one of the things that helps is if the culture in general starts to shift its attitude a little bit by saying that, look, this horrible thing happened. I mean, I even talk about ritualizing it to a certain extent right immediately after a battle. There's always a moment when you think about your dead friends. Include your dead enemies, too. And that, in a way, recognizes that you actually did kill somebody. And it's okay. Your friends actually killed somebody. Somebody on their side actually killed your friend. It begins to sort of, I don't know if the right word for this is, attenuate it. In other words, you begin to see that you were part of a very large picture. And even though you were the one that pulled the trigger, the people that made the ammunition were responsible, and the people that paid the taxes. So you don't feel like you're just all by yourself. In other words, I think that, I guess where I'm coming to is, in some ways, if you can feel that your whole culture is behind you and also takes responsibility for you being the hitman because you're 19 and you're fast, that's just the way it was. But that you alone aren't responsible for having killed this other person. Yeah, you pulled the trigger, but there's a whole lot behind it of interconnectedness. I'm a bit of a Buddhist that way. We are all so interconnected, and we just have to recognize it. And I think that is something that an awareness in the culture in general would help with that, plus these other tools that we do have and talked about.
No, I think actually that's a really good way of looking at it. I think you need a context, a kind of framework for thinking about it. I sort of look at it as, if we're going to do this, then the society needs to be fully engaged in the meaning of what it did or does, and that it's not. And of course, this then raises another question. You were in Vietnam. That was, at that time, primarily draftees. You were not a draftee. I know you joined.
Right.
You enlisted. You became an officer. But many of your compatriots were drafted. Not necessarily the Marines. You know, that's, I think the Marines
right.
were more.
Very few Marines were drafted. The ones that were, they usually, the Marine recruiters went to the draft lines and looked for anybody over 6 foot and said, you can come with
right.
us if you like.
Right,
you know?
They were picking guys that, in other words, so but leaving aside the Marines, the bulk of
right.
that war was fought by draftees.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And now, and I sort of have always felt somewhat, because this was not the subject of your book, but I always felt that somewhat cynically, Nixon realized that by drafting people, they were creating opposition to the war, and that by if they could make it a volunteer army, they would defuse a huge element, a big element in the societal response to war.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you know, if the other, if everybody else's kid, if your family doesn't have to send anybody and it's always somebody you don't know, it's a lot easier to say, yes, we'll let our kids go.
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, this is more into politics, but I worry for the Republic that with this all-volunteer military that we've gotten ourselves into, and I worry for the all-volunteer military because of the burden placed on them. But, I mean, I was at a reading in Fayetteville, which is right outside of Fort Bragg. Young couple comes up to me and you know, she's got a baby in her left arm and hauling a toddler, right? And they look like they're 3 years out of high school, and he's in his fatigues. And she starts crying, and I look at her, and I go, what's the matter? And she points to her husband, and she says, well, he's shipping out again in 2 days. And I turn to this kid, and I say, wow, is this your second tour? No, sir, this is my seventh.
Wow.
And my heart sank. Seven tours. I mean, that's an intolerable burden. All right, then you switch to the Republic. Oh, well, they volunteered. Well, they get paid. That's their job. We get so cynical. I mean, I hear that so often. Well, they volunteered. And no, there are no protests about the war. People are basically are not thinking about it because just of what you said. How many children of U.S., of you know, members of Congress are over there fighting? How many from the Ivy Leagues are over there fighting?
No, I agree completely. I think that in a republic, in a democracy where we believe that, and this may relate to, this is where it does relate to your book, because I think you're talking about how does war get integrated into the society and make, if we're going to have war, then the people who are involved in it need to have a better framework for what they're being asked to do. And if you have an all-volunteer army where the society itself can distance itself further and further and make those weapons invisible to them, that you make it harder for the society to reconcile what it's doing, and you make it harder for the people who are doing it to reconcile themselves. And not, as you said, I mean, this concept of an individual going to war forever is a bizarre idea. I mean, it's just got it. The suffering that has to cause those individual human beings to take all of that responsibility onto such a small number of people's shoulders seems wrong on its face.
It is. It is. And it's class structure, generally speaking. Like I said, the upper classes aren't involved. The other thing that I think is important is the one you alluded to, which is if everybody's rowing in the same boat, there's going to be a lot more thought about, you know, why are we over there? What are we doing? We essentially have got a Praetorian Guard right now. The president can commit the military. It says in our Constitution that only the Congress can declare war. But the president can commit this volunteer military with no fear of protests, basically. Oh, they volunteered. And they're all professional people. They're committed. You know, people in the military are amazing. They do what you tell them to do. But we've got a situation with a Praetorian Guard, and then once they're committed, well, what member of Congress is going to vote to not send them beans, bullets, and bandages? They're going to all go along with it because they're already over there fighting. And I think it takes away another example of how we lose our our republicanism and with small r's, you know, that we become more imperial in a way. The president can commit, the Congress has to go along with it. This sounds like Rome about the time of Julius Caesar, which is not a healthy political situation at all.
No, I agree. And I think it is both politically damaging and dangerous because it removes the responsibility for the accountability of the population for its own actions.
Yeah.
And it also, as you said, I mean, there's a certain... But the further the army and the military are alienated from the citizenry, the less likely it is that one can affect the other. It works in both directions, that the citizens will not understand the military won't understand the citizenry anymore.
Well, here's a great example. I was at a reading, woman came up to me, she'd read Matterhorn, and you know, sort of, you know, baby boomer age, and she said, you know, I was a protester against the war. I was at every protest I could go to. I just hated it. And then she pauses and she says, I didn't know you guys slept outside. College-educated woman didn't know we slept outside. I mean, I don't know what she was thinking. Well, the point is she wasn't thinking, and she felt a little embarrassed about it. But that goes to your point. If the culture is going to the place where they have the general population has no idea what they're asking the minority of the population to do, we're not a republic anymore.
That's right. No, I think that's unfortunately a frightening thought. And so while you didn't call for the end to the, you know, a reinstitution of the draft in your book, it is a kind of almost a necessary conclusion that if we really want to have a healthy society, we, the citizenry, have to be engaged in what the military is being asked to do. And that can work on many different levels.
I think so. And not everybody has to go and fight. I mean, I think that there's a moral issue about forcing somebody who really doesn't want to kill somebody to do it. That's a difficult thing, but there's so much work to do. I mean, I don't know what it would cost to have some kind of a national service where people could, you know, teach, you know, kids in inner cities and build trails in the national forest system. And out of that pool, we also have people that would join the military and get the benefits of the military, VA and things like that afterwards. It would be a more of a sense of we're all in the boat pulling our oar, and it would be more fair. I mean, Vietnam was terribly class structured. The current way the military is organized is very class structured. It's just not fair, and that would be eliminated. And people say, well, that'd cost a fortune. And I'm going like, what's our debt? 11 trillion, 9 trillion? I don't even know. I mean, compared to what we've spent already on wars that we've been fighting, I don't think it would be that expensive comparatively. And I mean, here's a great example. I grew up in this little logging town in Oregon. The first time that I ever had Mexican food was in Vietnam. Ray Delgado's mother sent him something called a tamale, and after I figured out he was laughing at me that you don't eat the outside of this thing, I said, what is this? And he says, it's a tamale. You've never had one, have you? I had never had Mexican food. It was only because I got thrown in with Ray Delgado that I actually was exposed to that part of my own culture. And that's important, too. You know, I just think that that's important.
Right. Well, it's the melting pot.
Yeah.
You know, the classic, all those war movies from World War II show, you know, every single one of them will show you, the mixture of who was in the platoon.
Exactly.
And the same thing is true in Vietnam. These are, you know, people rubbing shoulders who never would have met each other in, you know, kind of civilian life. They become forced by circumstance to... that's another benefit. This is like one of my memories from the early 70s. I was at a meeting in Vermont of an organic farming meeting, and these two guys recognized each other across the room, having, you know, that they had been in the same unit or something. I don't know what happened. It was like a sort of spiritual connection between these two guys and a reunion of experience of two human beings that had shared an experience that I've never seen in my life before or since. It really made a big impression on me. And I think it's that, you know, these weren't two guys who would have known each other in any other context, but the context of being in the same military unit and the same experience made them brothers in a way that was deeper than any other connection probably And I'm not going to romanticize that. I don't think that that's
Well,
necessarily.
I mean, you can. I mean, Vonnegut got into this with what he called carasses and grand falloons, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, you can romanticize. Oh, you were in the Navy. I was in the Navy, and we should be friends. You don't have to be friends because you were in the Navy, but you find people that go through similar experiences. I think women who have gone through childbirth have a different relationship to other women who have gone through childbirth than women who haven't.
That's true,
I think
and
it's just the
it's
way
yeah,
it is.
right, and it's experience men can never have,
Yeah.
and that's similarly, as if you have an experience, if you've been in war, then you have that shared connection that no one else can have if they've never been.
Yeah,
Well,
that's just true.
this is I we could go on forever. I know you have
Well,
to
great
go,
interview. Thank you.
but it was really fun talking to you about this. I think it's an amazing book. I did want to say this, and I'd want to say it at the beginning, but there were places in this book where I cried and I felt emotionally engaged, in a way that it was really important to me. So, I do feel that this book is one that I'd recommend to people and feel like this is a book that a lot, you have that certain books should be read by people because they will, because they can carry ideas that may change the way people think and feel. And I think that what it is like to go to war has that capability. So I really appreciate your writing this book. Anyway, thanks, Carl. And,
Yeah, thank you.
appreciate talking to you. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Carl Marlantes about what it is like to go to war, and I hope that everybody who hears this will want to go out and buy a copy of the book.